This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Growing up with dyslexia is no fun at all. Growing up with dyslexia and never being diagnosed and getting the proper educational help, that can make school a nightmare.
If the teacher's just dismissing it, do not be ashamed to say, you know, I think I'm going to do some testing on my own, because it's your right. You're the parent.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll meet Sonia Bridges, a teacher who grew up in that situation and is now reaching out to help others. Then we'll hear the story of another remarkable woman who's reaching out to bring education and hope to others, Hannah Slocum, in the West African country of Liberia. And we'll spend an academic minute seeing how women in the U.S. are being affected by the foreclosure crisis. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. There's a problem that can make a child's school years almost unbearable. Developmental reading disorder, more commonly known as dyslexia. It's a problem with areas of the brain that help interpret language. It's an equal opportunity condition affecting both boys and girls from all social, racial, and economic categories. Here to talk about dyslexia is Sonia Bridges, a former teacher who made it halfway through her PhD program before an official diagnosis revealed she has dyslexia and ADHD. Sonia is founder of A Family Affair, an organization that promotes literacy awareness nationally. We spoke recently, and I asked Sonia, by what age do the signs of dyslexia become apparent?
Second grade is a prime opportunity to start noticing. Really, I'll tell you, if there's a family history, it's a good idea to start watching from the first day of school, even in kindergarten. I started having problems as I look back over of course, I'm one of those that discovered that I was dyslexic later in life, and actually 2010. And as we look back over my school history, we remembered, you know, I started having problems in K-5 when I couldn't use my dominant hand. So honestly, you know, just be looking for those signs if there's some history in the family. But second grade usually is going to tell the tale when you start having problems with falling behind in reading, spelling, and things like that.
If you do have some family history and you get through second grade or third grade, can you start, like, taking a deep breath, saying, okay, I think we're in the clear here?
Yeah, you're probably going to pick it up before then. But also, I would keep watching, because if you've got that family history, you know, a lot of times people think that dyslexia is simply reversing letters and things like that. That's true, but it's not all there is to it. It's, you know, of course, it's difficulty with learning sound symbols, where they'll mess up B for D, W for M, and of course the auditory for D, the T. It's difficulty remembering basic sight vocabulary, problems with segmenting words into individual sounds and blending sounds, reading and spelling errors with omissions of letters and sounds. Difficulty with sequencing the alphabet, days of the week, months of the year, reversal, omissions, transpositions. To this day, I have problems with omissions, past, pats. A matter of fact, that's how I've been compensating all these years. When I was tested in June of 2010, I was making mistakes at a third grade reading level. So what I was doing is I was reading, and I would see the care ran fast. Well, it was car, but I saw it as care. Well, I would know that that sentence didn't make sense, so that's what I was doing. I was compensating. I would go back and say, wait, care? I would say car. So Those are some things to be, you know, to look for. It's not just all about reversal and things like that. When I go around and I talk to kids, which makes my life worth living, I enjoy it so much. And they'll want to say something to me, and I'll ask them a question if they're dyslexic, and it just will not come out. And I say, look, I know what you're trying to say. Don't worry about it. But they're really precious. They're trying. They know what they want to say, but it just won't come out. So I still struggle with finding words too.
Is this something a teacher is more likely to notice than a parent?
You know, I'm a former teacher, and so I certainly don't want to beat up on teachers, because they have an amazing calling in life. You don't get into teaching unless you've heard the call, so to speak, because why anyone would torture themselves like that intentionally, I don't know, because teaching is one of the hardest, most rewarding jobs that you'll ever get into. But they're not perfect. You've got, what, 20 kids in a class? It's hard to monitor and stay on top of things like you probably should. So as a parent, you're your child's best advocate. If your child is studying and putting forth effort and not getting back what you think he should on the grades, then there's probably something to look at there. Go talk to the teacher and say, hey, you know, have you noticed some things, especially if that family history is involved, because we're concerned. You know, just open up that dialogue with the teacher and say, here's why I'm asking. There's some family history, and we just want to stay on top of this, and we want to know if you've noticed, and maybe go over some characteristics of the dyslexia.
When is it time to stop talking to a teacher and start talking to a doctor?
You're probably, most situations, you're going to have to get permission to be tested from the principal. But in most of the cases, they're going to go along with it. But if they don't, like I said, you're the parent. You got to take the bull by the horns and go get them tested. Go get your child tested, because early intervention is the key. If the teacher's just dismissing it, do not be ashamed to say, you know, I think I'm going to do some testing on my own, because it's your right. You're the parent.
You say you have 6 things that parents can do for their dyslexic children. What are those things?
I have a tip list, if you would. The first one, trust your gut. That's basically what I've been saying. Always remember that you know your child better than anyone. The second thing, draft a homework contract. And, you know, some of these things you can do even if your child's not dyslexic. I think it's a wonderful idea. Most of them would work with any child. By drafting a homework contract, parents are enacting several positives at once, such as teaching goals and organization. Also, we talked about occupying the other side of the brain in my tips. Let me start by saying that holding a squishy ball may not work for all, because I recommended maybe holding a squishy ball during homework time with a hand that's not doing the writing. ADHD plays a huge factor with dyslexics. Not all cases, but in most cases where dyslexia is involved, you're going to have some ADHD factors. So a squishy ball or some other object may distract, or it may be perfect for the situation. Recently, I've noticed that when I'm trying to concentrate and or in deep thought, I have some other activity going on that's keeping me honestly focused. I had a student when I was teaching that I could tell when he was completely engaged with what I was saying, when his shoes would come off and he would begin to roll his feet around in his shoes. And so this is the point where insisting on being still or not fidgeting isn't important. You know when they're engaged, so sometimes it may be a good thing for them to be a little active, because they're focusing more. And I also recommended to ramp up positivity. As much as I despised school, I enjoyed shopping for supplies. My mother would always try to make it exciting. She would say positive things. It's a new year, new supplies. And we would go shopping for clothes. And then she would try to keep reiterating that, you know, it's a new year. It's a fresh start. So, you know, let's start it off in a positive fashion. And she tried to make both of us think that the year was going to be great. And then I believe goal setting is important. And we talked about the homework contract and how it could definitely be a way to teach kids how to set goals and reap rewards from achieving the said goal. But I encourage parents to help their children to look for other ways to encourage their children to set goals. Those are just some tips that I comprised, and I think that they would be beneficial, like I said, not only to dyslexics and to all kids.
Tell us about A Family Affair, the organization you put together.
A Family Affair, you know, when I discovered that I was dyslexic, I went through a time that I thought, why have I discovered this now in my life? I'm almost finished with my education, and all those years that I struggled, it would have been nice to know. So I went through a time where I didn't understand why. that I had found out at this stage in my life. You know, I had dreams, like all kids. You know, I wanted to be maybe a veterinarian. Well, where my dyslexia really affected me was in the math portion, and I could not do math. So I got the college handbook out, and I saw that if you're going to be in the veterinarian programs, you're going to have to do a lot of chemistry and things like that. So there was no way on God's green earth that I could do veterinarian medicine. But those are some of the things that I had to learn how to work around. But I knew, I started thinking after I was diagnosed, I know that my life would have been different. And I went through a time where, like I said, I was kind of bitter. But I got over that, and I realized everything happens for a reason. And I believe that I've discovered that I'm dyslexic because I have to tell the story. There's so many kids and families out there that need to hear, just because your child's dyslexic doesn't mean that it's a sentence for them not to be a failure in life. In fact, they can do whatever they want to do with their life if they work hard and they have perseverance. And that's why I formed A Family Affair. And what we do with the foundation is I have a book called A Snail's Pace, and all the proceeds from the book goes to the foundation, and we establish scholarships and grants and things like that to help dyslexic kids and their families, because a lot of times dyslexics, they may want to go to college, but they're not going to have the grades probably to be in the running for an academic scholarship. But they have potential too, and those are some of the things that we're trying to do. And we also try to establish dyslexic therapy programs in schools as well.
Sonia Bridges is a teacher and the founder of A Family Affair, an organization that promotes literacy awareness nationally. Still to come, a special woman is bringing education and hope to the women of Liberia. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1127. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. By almost every measure, the West African country of Liberia is one of the worst places in the world to be a woman. In the aftermath of a brutal civil war, women have limited access to medical care, jobs, and education. Rape is so common that many women don't even know it's a crime. Most women raise children on their own, on less than a dollar a day. But in one part of that country, women have made progress, thanks to Liberian Hannah Slocum. Ma Hannah, as she's affectionately known, has made it her life's work to lift Liberia out of poverty by bringing education and hope one woman at a time. The World Vision Report's Prue Clark has the story.
At the end of a dirt track in Bay, a tiny village of palm trees and mud huts, women sing about love. Only with love, their song goes, can peace take hold. Life's been hard for these women. During 14 years of civil war, they lost children and husbands to hunger, fighting, disease. Even after the war ended 8 years ago, life looked bleak. But today there are smiles here. Almost all the women of Bay are now part of a profitable produce business, and their children are in school. Life's still tough. Liberia is desperately poor and violence is endemic. But the people here see a brighter future. The woman they thank for their new lives is 59-year-old Hannah Slocum.
There aren't words to say how important she is.
Jenny Mars is 40 years old and a widow. Like women throughout this part of rural Liberia, she calls Slocum simply Ma Hannah.
Yo.
She's my husband. She's my God. I have no mother, no father. She is everybody for me.
Hannah Slocum is a nurse. She was born in the nearby town of Kakata. It's where she now runs a women's health clinic. But Hannah does far more for the women of her region than just provide medical care. She helps them become self-sufficient, not an easy task in this destitute land. On this morning, Hannah is in Bay to check in with some of the women she's helped. She's also pressing them to register for the upcoming election. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Africa's first woman president, is running for a second term, and Slocum wants the women to support her.
My Ellen doing well. She's trying her best. So let us try to register to vote her back in for the second term. The way she got to do a plenty. She can.
Hannah Slocum first stepped foot in Bay 4 years ago. She found a village full of traumatized women, women like Jenny Mars.
My life was just down.
Mars was brutally raped during the war. Rebels also shot and killed her husband in front of her. Mars's injuries were so bad, it was 4 years until she could walk again. Her four children went days without food. Another villager, Julia Blama, watched two of her children and her parents die of starvation.
I lost hope at that time. I lost hope after my parents died. I thought I might not even make it.
Then came Hannah Slocum and her cassava machine. Here in the center of the village, under a large mango tree, children gather with Hannah to watch quietly as Jenny Mars washes cassava tubers to prepare them for the grinding machine. When Hannah arrived in Bay, her first task was to find a way for the women here to make a living. So she taught them to grow cassava more efficiently, and she brought them this machine to grind it. On this steamy morning, Jenny Mars starts the machine and piles half a dozen tubers into the feeding chute. The metal box has a grinder attached to a small motor. Out the other end comes a pulpy mass that's dried and sold as a kind of oatmeal.
I grind the cassava so we can sell it in the market.
What once took days by hand now takes 15 minutes. The women of Bay say that before Hannah came, they were lucky to earn $4 a month. Now they can make 50.
I feel very proud of my life now.
I feel very proud of my life now. I'm able to go out and encourage women. Ma Hannah changed my life.
Julia says with money coming in, she's been able to keep all her children in school. And Hannah did more than just help with the cassava. She also taught the women marketable skills like sewing and cooking. Jenny jokes that many people here would like to see Ma Hannah run for president of Liberia.
Everybody would vote for her. The little baby, he would vote for her.
Hannah has done this same work for women in remote villages all across this part of Liberia. She's done it for 40 years. But it was during the war that she became legendary. Liberia's civil war was one of Africa's most brutal. It brought to power warlord Charles Taylor and his rebel army. Back at the Kakata clinic, Hannah picks up the story. Patients hang on her words. One day, says Hannah, she and her family came to a rebel checkpoint as they were fleeing the fighting. The checkpoint had become notorious as God Bless You Gate. If you passed through alive, it was said, God blessed you. A young rebel told Hannah to hand over a chicken she was carrying. Hannah was tired and hungry and refused. As the boy lifted his arm to hit Hannah, his commander intervened.
He said, "Oh, Ma Hannah." He called all the soldiers. He said, "I know this lady. She saved me when I was in Kakata. I had pneumonia and she treated me. So you respect her."
The commander told Hannah to pull her family aside. All the refugees at the gate, most of them strangers, crowded around her.
At that junction, who I deny anybody? So everybody became my family. There I was able to save all those people.
And she's still saving lives. Her clinic offers prenatal care and family planning. And in an annex, Hannah has started another project, a small vocational school. On this afternoon, women are in the annex learning to sew on half a dozen donated machines. There are also classes in weaving, reading and writing.
Hannah says she's still a long way from achieving all her goals. She wants more medical care, more vocational training, more opportunities for these women. This is the key, she says, to securing Liberia's future.
We the women have to take the lead in uniting each other, uniting our mind. Peace can come to the country through the women.
As Hannah watches, 40-year-old Molly Kohaney spells her own name.
S-E-N.
Molly's also learned to weave cloth here, and now she earns enough to feed her children and send them to school. She says Hannah's done what she long thought impossible. She's given Molly her life back. In Kakata, Liberia, I'm Prue Clark for the World Vision Report.
And again, Prue's story comes to us courtesy of the World Vision Report. Some women in the U.S. are facing some very difficult financial situations. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm your host, Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The foreclosure crisis has dominated headlines in recent years. Today, Professor Karen McCormick of Wheaton College explores whether women and minorities can recover from losing their homes.
Home ownership is considered an important part of the American dream, a marker of citizenship, adulthood, and middle-class status. We associate the owner-occupied house with the idea of home, a locus of stability, control, and freedom. The ongoing foreclosure crisis has challenged our association of home ownership with stability and control, drawing attention to the risks associated with mortgage debt. My recent research with families at risk of foreclosure raises questions about equating house and home and reveals that losing the home has costs far beyond the financial. Along with high levels of stress and increased health problems, at-risk owners fear a loss of credibility in the eyes of family and friends, and also fear the long-term financial consequences of foreclosure. While these families struggle to renegotiate and fend off loss, they also work hard to explain how they are fiscally responsible. People who have lost homes to foreclosure are often blamed for the situation. Media reports suggest that if they had only bought smaller homes and been more careful about financing, they wouldn't have gotten in trouble. Often the difference between the foreclosed and everyone else is a job loss, or an illness, or a separation. Combined with the decreasing value of houses, these became catastrophic events in the lives of families across the country. One result of this crisis is a price correction in the value of houses, but perhaps it could also lead us to reconsider the meaning of home. Because we put such stock in ownership, good rental options are often not available. In ignoring other forms of housing, we frequently relegate the working poor to substandard housing, making families choose between inadequate housing or mortgage debt. The foreclosure crisis has exposed the cracks in the foundation of our concept of home. As we rebuild, we need to reconsider expanding the meaning of home so ownership is not the only route to residential security and control.
That was Karen McCormick of Wheaton College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.